From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, we'll talk a little bit about intuition. Here's what's happening. Now, my intuition right now tells me things aren't too well with Korea, that's for sure. A plan to assassinate Kim Jong-un and preparations for a potential nuclear showdown with North Korea were among the trove of South Korean military documents reportedly stolen by North Korean hackers. South Korea's defense ministry did not comment on the alleged hack, which reportedly occurred in September of 2016, but was only revealed just recently by a lawmaker in South Korea. The hack consisted of 235 gigabytes of military documents, and about 80% of what was stolen has not even been identified yet. The University of Hawaii students reportedly opened up their inbox to find an email headlined, "In the event of a nuke attack, an ominous message sent as North Korea continues to threaten a missile attack on the United States." The email to students and faculty members gave instructions to shelter in place if a nuclear or ballistic missile attack by Kim Jong-un's regime did occur. Let's check in with Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com, for his reaction to everything that's going on today. John, what do you think?
Well, I mean, you had Defense Secretary Mattis speaking to a convention today, Army convention, saying that he is informing the Army, all status of command, that they must be ready for a military option. And there's a report out now, one of the reasons that links North Korea and Iran together is a report, George, that's very curious, of North Korea opening an embassy in Tehran and detailed collaboration going on between the missile technology that North Korea has developed and the Iranians. And so I think now that what you're looking at with North Korea and Iran has been linked. And I think that both those countries are plotting, basically, to conspire against the United States.
You know, John, also there's a report that Iran has not stopped its nuke program at all, but continues to move ahead.
Well, that's exactly why, on two fronts, Trump will he will not cancel the Iran nuke deal. What he'll do is he'll decertify it, because Iran is in non-compliance, not allowing IEA inspectors into their military sites, where it is conceivable that not only the nuclear militarizing the uranium enrichment has gone on, but the work on a nuclear design has continued. So yes, the Iran nuke deal is not in compliance, and now that there's collaboration with North Korea, I think the situation is deteriorating rapidly.
I think, John, if there's one more missile test, either toward Japan or toward the United States, as Charles R. Smith thinks it could happen soon, we're going to have all heck break loose.
Well, I think so. But I think people need to realize that as far as, like, World War III breaking out, there's very little support that North Korea has other than rogue nations like Iran. China really considers North Korea a nuisance. Vladivostok, as you know, is very close to the North Korean and Russian border, so they're very concerned about any fallout from any kind of a military confrontation. But the real issue for China is the reunification, the attempt at reunification by the South Koreans and the United States. They've already been informed that that will not happen under any kind of a scenario, a military attack on North Korea. And that in all likelihood, the Chinese would wind up serving as a custodial government until you could stabilize that country. So for the folks out there screaming, this is World War III in the making, tell me who the players are in the World War, because it's not going to be Russia, it's not going to be China, and it's not going to be any other regime that we know of, maybe Iran.
All right, John, thank you. Dr. John Curtis's website, onlinecolumnist.com. A vampire scare in Malawi in Africa is reportedly responsible for mob violence that's resulted in the deaths of at least five people, prompting the United Nations to pull its entire staff in the area. The eruption of vampire-driven vigilante violence in the African nation came after rumors surfaced back in September that real-life bloodsuckers were creating all kinds of problems. These reports prompted the formation of lynch mobs who've accused people of being vampires. New fingerprint technology that can profile a criminal's lifestyle could soon be admissible in court. It's capable of detecting traces of drugs, blood, alcohol, hair, cleaning products, other substances of forensic interest. According to researchers, that could help investigators learn more about a criminal's activities just from a single fingerprint. Isn't that amazing? Well, they say the U.S. economy continues to roar. As a matter of fact, the latest CNBC economic survey shows optimism in the American economy at a 10-year high. The manufacturing activity is at a 13-year high. Service sector activity is at a 12-year high. There are a record 6.2 million open jobs in America, and semi-truck sales are out of control strong right now. Let's check in with registered investment advisor Mitch Michael Shedlock here. Mitch, do you agree with all of this?
I don't think I do, George, and I don't think you do, and I don't think the listeners do either. The last jobs report, well, they was really anemic. We can blame that on the hurricanes, but also we can blame on the hurricanes. They're ramping up car production to restock the dealers' lots. We had hundreds and hundreds of thousands of cars that were flooded and damaged in those hurricanes. So a lot of the manufacturing activity we see is related to that. I think we're in for a very deflationary setup, George. I'm looking at demographics here. The largest age group, do you know what it is in the U.S.? 26-year-olds, followed by 27, 25, and 24. These are millennials. They're trapped in debt. Marketers are trying to figure out how to advertise to this group. The spending from the boomers who are retiring is going to be tapering off. When this asset bubble first, it's going to be a very, very deflationary setup. Things always look good, George, at the top. I've said this before. They look good at the top of the housing bubble. They look good in 2000, right before the dot-com bubble burst. I think we're in for another round of that, George.
Oh, boy. Thanks, Mitch. Appreciate it. A video has popped up on YouTube, which purportedly shows a UFO zigzagging over the Yellowstone volcano, the caldera. The choppy video, which is more than 3 minutes in length, appears to show a metallic object in the sky. A bright light emerges from the object for a few seconds. It's amazing. Talking about Yellowstone and that caldera, boy, if that thing ever goes, what a mess we're going to have. So we're going to bring up in a moment Catherine Miles. Her latest work is called Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. Catherine is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. So where do you think the next major earthquake might be? Los Angeles, San Francisco, somewhere around the New Madrid Fault? Well, well, well. Catherine Miles back with us. Her latest work is called Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. Catherine currently serves as a writer in residence for the Green Mountain College and as a faculty member for Chatham University. She has a Bachelor of Arts in Philosophy from St. Louis University, received her Ph.D. in English from the University of Delaware, and dedicates her life to uncovering previously ignored narratives and characters. She's the author of a book we had her on about 3 years ago called Superstorm, 9 days Inside Hurricane Sandy. Catherine, welcome back.
Hi, hard to believe 3 years have gone by.
Oh my, huh? Way too fast. And I'm in St. Louis right now. I'm going to head back to Los Angeles next week, but I'm doing my shows here. And St. Louis U is a great, great university, by the way.
Billikens.
All the way. Are you from St. Louis or you just ended up going to school there?
I'm from Central Illinois originally and went to school there. And, I remember really vividly doing earthquake drills to get ready for the next one.
Oh, yeah. It's right on that fault, a big fault indeed. Tell me a little bit about Quakeland.
Sure. So this is a road trip around America. looking at seismic hazard, looking at some of the wild and crazy and super smart scientists who are trying to figure out how our Earth works, and looking at seismic risk and what we've done to prepare for it, what we still need to do, looking at some of the ways, some of the really wild ways, I think, that we've set off earthquakes around the country, around the world, really, and the way in which humans are really changing the face of seismic hazard around the world.
Let's talk science for just a second. Why do earthquakes form? What happens?
So there are a variety of different reasons why earthquakes happen. I sort of liken it to a, sort of if you fill up a water balloon too fast and it eventually explodes. I mean, what you have is you have that, in our case, that the water in that balloon is building pressure at a weakness in the earth. It can be because two plates are moving against each other, either side by side or one moving under another. It can be because that weakness is there and the pressure is changing around it for a different reason. So what's happening is that pressure becomes too much and it forces a weak area in the planet, a fault, if you will, to give, basically. And it sort of lurches as a result of that pressure, and that lurch sends out waves, seismic waves. And if you think of, for instance, throwing a log or a branch or something into water, and you kind of imagine those rings that would throw out as a result, that's the sort of physical effect in terms of physics that's happening and why it is that we feel the damage and the shaking after it occurs.
Catherine, we just saw the tragedy in Mexico City with that earthquake. It just amazing what happens when Mother Nature decides to rumble. I know some people who, of course, still remember the Northridge quake in California several years ago as well. These are big, and I'm not sure, even though they say a lot of our buildings that they have now are earthquake proof, I'm not sure they are. What do you think?
Yeah. You know, I mean, building codes is a really sort of complicated issue. It's an issue as a country we need to be looking a lot more at. You know, pound for pound, there is no more powerful natural disaster than an earthquake, you know, and in seconds, an earthquake can do, frankly, a lot more significant damage than, you know, even the worst of the hurricanes. One of the things that really surprised me researching this book is just how little even the best scientists know about how they start, why they start, where they start. So that's part of what makes them so deadly, too, is that at this point, we're not able to predict them. We're not able to forecast them. Our country doesn't have an early warning system, unlike other countries like Mexico and Japan. So we can't even give folks that 30-second, 45-second warning that some other countries
will,
can.
Will that make a difference, Catherine, that 30 or 40 seconds?
Absolutely. And we saw that in Mexico, you know, and I doubted this a lot, but I spent some time out at the University of California, Berkeley, which is sort of the real locus for where a lot of this research is happening. And they have a beta early warning program out there. Congress hasn't yet funded it as a national program, but the technology is available and they're using it there. And, you know, I doubted that too. I thought, well, what can you really do in 30 seconds? But, you know, we practiced, and in 30 seconds, you can grab your kid out of bed, you can grab your go bag, you can get under a table at the household level. At the community level, you can stop a train, you can divert a plane that's about to land, you can shut down a tunnel. And really, those sorts of things can actually be the difference between life and death for hundreds, if not thousands of people.
Okay, so you got involved in this in a big way, and you traveled everywhere checking, and we'll talk about that. You've been all over the place. What was it that really piqued your interest?
What surprised me more than anything was this notion of induced seismicity, this way in which we set off earthquakes. And some of your listeners are probably familiar with what's happening in Oklahoma, the huge spate of earthquakes that they're seeing there as a result of wastewater injection relating to fracking and oil extraction. And that's certainly, I think, the most newsworthy way in terms of what the media has been covering lately. But as it turns out, we set off earthquakes for all kinds of different ways. You know, when we built the Hoover Dam in the decade that followed, the filling of the reservoir behind the dam set off something like 10,000 earthquakes. We set them off through mining, building tunnels, building even high-rise buildings can set off earthquakes. The U.S. military set off quite a few earthquakes in the 1960s, trying to inject waste from our chemical weapons program in Colorado. And so just understanding that through technology, through our activities, we have the ability to really change the face a seismic hazard. And I think recognizing that and recognizing the added risk that that poses, and the fact that, not only, you know, can we change the weather or change the climate, we can also change the very planet, and understanding the responsibility that that comes with.
You've interviewed a lot of people, engineers, construction experts, scientists. What kind of things did you talk with them about when you put the book Quakeland together? And any stories pop up on your mind?
And they are just absolutely heroic, these scientists who are doing this research. It's incredibly frustrating research. You know, some of them have never even experienced an earthquake. You know, they want to, but it's a kind of...
I have felt, just by being in the Midwest and living in L.A. sometimes too, some rumbles, little ones, but, you know, 3s, 3.4, something like that. But I've never felt the big one. But tell us about these scientists and engineers.
Yeah, you know, and they're doing really great, really difficult work. When you think about it, you know, an earthquake occurs, say, 5 miles underground, or some cases 30 miles underground. And so it's not like you can get down there and actually see what's happening. You know, in a way, this is sort of like being an astrophysicist who's trying to talk about dark matter, things that are so far beyond the spectrum of our sensory perceptions that, you know, it's really difficult. But they're doing really great work. They were incredibly selfless in terms of allowing me in their labs, allowing me to, you know, crawl around the turbines of the Hoover Dam or in the subways in New York. And so it was a really great experience for me as sort of classic participatory journalism to get to spend days with these folks and to kind of see what they do, see what they're doing to try to save us, and frankly start to see a little bit of a window into how our planet works.
Are they concerned at all about a big one happening?
Absolutely. And one of the things I really wanted to stress in this book is I think we all have a tendency to sort of feel like an earthquake is a California problem. And
right.
It is a California problem. And you know, the greatest thing approaching certainty that we have is that there will be, you know, a significant earthquake in Southern California probably in our lifetimes. And scientists are in pretty much close, you know, not total agreement, that the chance of that is, you know, 95-99%, right? So, you know, those are odds you never see in science. But that's not the only place where an earthquake is possible. And as I joke in the book, unless you live in Miami, you really are at a potential risk for an earthquake. And this includes major metropolitan centers like New York City, which is about 40 years overdue for an earthquake, the Pacific Northwest, Memphis and St. Louis, Washington, D.C., you know, places that we don't necessarily equate with earthquake possibilities, and as you mentioned earlier, you know, don't really have the building codes in place, let alone the sort of emergency management plans to manage that if it is going to occur.
How important, in your opinion, gravitational pulls from full moons and new moons and things like that?
You know, that's really interesting, and that's something that scientists have certainly been looking into. They're a little bit divided in terms of just how powerful that is in terms of the ability to set off earthquakes. There is some evidence that that does occur. But the problem is that because we don't know where that next quake is going to happen, it's really hard to get things like the monitoring stations and things in place there. And so right now there's a lot of speculation, there's a lot of hypotheses about what exactly causes them. One thing we do know is that water is intrinsically related to a lot of these quakes. You'll see an earthquake happen in, say, Idaho, and the water table levels, the well levels, will be affected in places like Hawaii and Puerto Rico. We know that water extraction, you know, or water injection can really change that as well. And so
fracking,
keep that in mind.
Fracking can do this too?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's something that we've seen, especially in places like Alberta. We've seen, and off the coast of California in the 1930s, 1940s, we saw oil extraction out there causing earthquakes there as well, too. So, you know, anytime we're changing the pressure inside the earth, whether, you know, we're increasing it or decreasing it through our activities, we have the potential to have that pressure, you know, reach a weak place, a fault in the earth, and set off a quake.
And Catherine, even though you said Florida is somewhat immune from an earthquake, they, of course, get hit by hurricanes. You can't get away from Mother Nature, can you?
you cannot, you know, and even though, you know, a hurricane and an earthquake, even though the actual event looks very different, what we've seen, if you look at, for instance, Puerto Rico right now and Mexico
right now,
we see that the effects are very, very similar.
Absolutely. Devastation all the way. Catherine, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more about your work, Quakeland. In the next hour, we'll open up the phone lines with you on Coast to Coast AM. Well, the Coast to Coast October Trivia Contest is rolling along. Now, to those of you who don't know what it is, there's a weekly prize every week, $500, to the winner who gets the most questions right. And then what happens, we give you a brand new set of questions every day, Monday through Friday. If you're right, you get your name put into literally a hat, and then there'll be a drawing at the end of the week with all the winning entries, people who've gotten the question right, for the $500. And we're going to do that, and there's a winning person every week for the next 4 weeks in October. Now, all the questions are at coasttocoastam.com, but I'm going to read one to you. Here it is. According to recent guest Heidi Hollis, which of the following items is the Sinister Man, the Hat Man, not said to wear? Not said to wear. A, fedora. B, three-piece suit. C, trench coat. D, Rolex watch. Now, for entry info and rules, visit coasttocoastam.com. And for more information, you'll see those questions that I just gave you. And, you know, fill it out, get the information. I hope you're right, and go for it. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Catherine Miles with us. Her book is called Quakeland. Catherine, let's get into some of these stories that you really found fascinating or frightening from some of the people you talked about. What's out there?
Yeah, you know, and I think that this idea, again, of this induced seismicity, this idea that we are literally setting off earthquakes is something that I think most Americans, certainly I wasn't really aware of as I was researching this book, and something really to keep in mind, this idea that, you know, and this is something that, for instance, miners have known for 100 years, you know, they call them rock bursts, and, you know, coal miners have seen this happen, have seen, you know, friends and coworkers injured or even killed by this sort of seismic activity. But, you know, as we're digging deeper and deeper and deeper, whether it's for mines, whether it's for tunnels, those earthquakes are getting potentially bigger, right, and getting more dangerous. And not just for the people underground, but now what we see is this sort of seismic activity has real impact above ground as well, too. And so I think that that's really something for us to keep in mind. And I think it comes into play in all sorts of different ways, both in terms of the decisions that we make in terms of the way in which we want to use the planet, where we want to build, how we want to respond to it. And it comes up, I think, again, also when we're looking at the sort of changing face of seismicity and seismic risk, as we consider things like, for instance, President Trump's decision to sort of reinvest in Yucca Mountain and nuclear storage there. I think we really have to ask these questions about the real seismic hazard out there. What's at risk? What's safe? What we're going to do about it?
Well, we're going to have to, and we're going to have to do that fast. Now, we really don't know when the big one's going to happen. People have made predictions, but we don't know for sure, do we?
Not at all. And we probably never will. You know, as a country, we've invested a lot of money in different sort of predictive studies. That was particularly true in the 1970s and the 1980s, where we really tried hard to be able to invest in understanding how that was going to work, millions and millions and millions of dollars. But that has proved elusive. What the scientists I spoke to for the book told me is that it will probably always prove elusive, that at best we're going to have this 30 seconds to 60 seconds of warning before the next quake. And so because we don't know when and where, it's really incumbent upon all of us to be prepared. Everything from the way in which we build our buildings, the way in which we set up our communities, to sort of our personal responsibility, what we're going to do to make sure that we're safe within the household.
Catherine, why do we seem to be getting stranger and weirder storms? I mean, they just seem unnatural.
You know, and it's such a good question. And if this season made anyone,
oh my God,
kind of look for Armageddon, or
they don't stop. You know, there's another one after Nate that just came through. They just don't stop.
And, you know, and it's not just hurricanes, right? We have hurricanes, we have earthquakes, we have wildfires. You know, it really honestly is an exceptional, exceptional year. And there are some reasons. You know, what we do know in terms of storms in terms of hurricane storms is that the ocean is warming. And as the oceans warm, a couple of few things happen. Hurricanes get more fuel, and so they become bigger and stronger. They also become harder to predict, and they also occur and happen less like sort of typical hurricanes. And that's certainly something that we saw with Superstorm Sandy, where the storm itself was this sort of hybrid storm, half nor'easter, half hurricane. We also see things like, for instance, you know, Maria, which, you know, Category 5, just because we don't have a Category 6, you know, but massive storm. We saw the tremendous flooding earlier this year in places like Houston as well. So what scientists think right now is that as, you know, the climate changes, as oceans warm, as sea levels rise, we're not necessarily going to see more storms, but what we are going to see is more powerful storms, greater surge, storms behaving in more sort of unpredictable ways. And, you know, as we see other things like development, as we see things like drought, we're going to see, you know, an increase in fires. As we see more mm-hmm. human activity, like wastewater injection from fracking, we're going to see more earthquakes. So certainly, I think that the onus and the responsibility for, you know, claiming some of this really does lie with us. And it's, you know, easy to kind of be an ostrich and kind of put your head in the sand and say, we're not doing this. But science suggests otherwise.
Where are we with new technology that can help us with preparedness and early warning systems? What's out there?
And there is some fascinating work happening. Some very smart engineers are working on sort of storm responsive buildings that, you know, just sort of through smart technology know how to respond, whether it's automatically closing storm shutters or whether it's being able to sort of sway to the shaking in a different way. Some of the most interesting research that I saw while I was working on the book was some crowdsourcing work that's being done, kind of participatory citizen science, if you will. You know, and if you think about it, you know, the way in which we know that things like earthquakes are coming is seismometers, which are these really tricky, catchy little devices. They're expensive. We don't have a lot of them, especially in places away from the West Coast. And so it's hard to monitor these phenomenon and to know when they're going to happen and send out warnings. But what we all have right now are smartphones. And
that's right.
A smartphone has in it an altimeter, basically, that works kind of like, it's what decides whether or not that your phone should be in portrait or landscape, right? So it sees the way in which you're moving it. And it knows how to respond if you've just sort of used it to look at a picture and had your picture switch. That's that technology. Well, that technology can distinguish between shaking that you're doing because you're at a dance party or you dropped your phone and shaking caused by earthquakes. And so there's a really interesting program coming out of UCal Berkeley right now where they're saying, look, you know, if you'll let us use your location device and we'll anonymize it, we're not, you know, trying to keep up on you and kind of play Big Brother here, but if you'll let us kind of do that, then what we can do is we can sort of track the movement in the phone. And when we see that happening sort of, you know, in, you know, multiple phones at the same time, we know that an earthquake is happening. And so in exchange kind of for using that information, we could also send you off an early warning. So if the people 5 miles from you, their phone starts shaking first, you know, that's enough time for us to send you a text that says, hey, listen, earthquake coming, you know, take cover. And I think that that's a fascinating approach. It costs, you know, taxpayers very little money. It allows scientists to do a ton of really interesting work. And then it gives the added benefit of early warnings. And in places like Nepal, hugely earthquake active places that don't have those seismometers in place, places like New York City, Washington, you know, it really can make a huge difference for folks.
There was a time where meteorologists were able to do a better job predicting the outcome of just plain weather patterns. What happened? It's changed.
Yeah, you know, and I think that a lot of meteorologists would say that they're doing a better job than ever. I think that they would say, look, you know, we're actually getting more sophisticated as our weather satellite technology changes. So I think that that's part of it. I think that, you know, this idea of like a 5-day forecast is, you know, a sort of comparatively new forecast system. But, you know, there's a couple of things happening. You know, as a country, we have underinvested in our sort of what I call our sort of metaphoric technology, right, and our metaphoric infrastructure. So for quite a while, for instance, we had our civilian weather satellite program tied to our defense satellite program. Mm-hmm. It was a very sort of awkward relationship. And, you know, when the relationship was finally severed, we had a real sort of satellite deficit. We also had, incidentally, some sort of unfortunate connection that didn't get severed, for instance, between the computer mainframes. And that's part of why we saw the weather satellite hack that happened about 2 years ago. We believe it was actually hackers trying to get into the Department of Defense through our civilian weather satellite program. So, you know, reinvesting in that, reinvesting in the technology. Certainly we've seen with hurricane tracking that the European model outperforms the U.S. model right now because the European Union has decided to invest in that. So I think it's really a question of, you know, where are our priorities? Are we willing to invest in the technology that allows these very talented scientists, these meteorologists, these seismologists, to go out and do their work and get better at, say, a seven-day forecast, get better at that early warning system, understanding what triggers earthquakes so we can have a better sense of you know, where the real risk is on any given day.
And, Catherine, now, when you scoured the country looking for possibilities of where earthquakes could hit, how many places did you go? And are there some areas that could really severely be impacted and create problems for us?
Yeah, you know, and the short answer, unfortunately, is most places, right? Most places have the potential for an earthquake. And, you know, I drove around the country and went to certainly as many places as I can. It was a year-long road trip. And I think that you know, for my money, you know, where I'm particularly concerned right now are the population centers, you know, and we can talk about earthquake in terms of hazard, and we can talk about it in terms of risk. And some places are more likely to see an earthquake. So, for instance, Alaska, Hawaii, certainly the most likely places to see an earthquake just because of where they fall on tectonic plates. But the population centers are very small, right? So while there's a better chance of an earthquake there, the overall effect of that earthquake is much smaller than, say, New York City, very much at risk for an earthquake, and even a moderate quake there, one that, you know, you could argue they're 40 years overdue for, that same quake that could happen in, say, Wyoming, if it happens in New York City, the devastation is going to be significantly bigger just because of how much we've built there, just because of how many people there, how much literal infrastructure is there.
And since you've been doing this, have you found that worldwide we're having the same issues, or is it just a United States problem? I would guess it's happening all around the planet.
Yeah, it's definitely a worldwide problem, and we certainly see these ebbs and flows in terms of earthquake activity. But, you know, I mean, I don't think anyone has forgotten 2011, the Fukushima nuclear disaster. You know, certainly, you know, areas that are still evacuated, we're still really only beginning to understand the real effects of what happened when that meltdown occurred, you know, and understanding the potential risk for that. You know, if we go back just a little bit further to, say, 2004, and we think about that incredibly deadly Indian Ocean tsunami, it's absolutely a global problem. Some countries do better than others. Back to this idea of this early warning system, you know, Mexico has an early warning system. Taiwan, Japan, some European countries even have these early warning systems. So these are countries that have chosen to invest in that. It's a simple, elegant technology. We have it in place. With sort of appropriations from Congress, it could be the case right now that every American gets a text when an earthquake is coming. And, you know, I guess my question would be, why wouldn't we do that? Why wouldn't we invest in something that could save lives? And that frankly, is not all that expensive to do.
No, it's not. But do you predict personally, based on where you've been, what you've seen, something major happening?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and we can't say when. We've tried really hard to be able to say when, but you know, we do know That, for instance, you know, if you look at the San Andreas fault zone, arguably our most famous fault zone, scientists agree that, you know, that something as close to certainty as we possibly can have, that there will be a significant earthquake in, say, Southern California, quite possibly in our lifetime. We know that based on something called return rates, which is looking at the sort of historic occurrence of earthquakes over, say, a millennia, we know that the New Madrid Fault, which affects a great deal in the Midwest, particularly places like St. Louis and Memphis, you know, that a very large earthquake is a very real risk there. We don't know when it'll happen. It could be tomorrow. It could be in 300 years. But when you take a look at a place like Memphis, you know, that doesn't necessarily pop up on most of our sort of personal radar screens as a major problem, right? It's Memphis. It's the blues. It's barbecue.
That's right.
But what I think a lot of people don't realize is that Memphis is, in a lot of ways, the commercial hub for our country. You know, we have FedEx located there. We have UPS located there, all at the Memphis International Airport. We have something like 4 million packages moving through Memphis every single night. And these are everything from mortgage checks and paychecks to your Amazon order. But it's also the U.S. Mail Service. They're the number one subcontractors who use FedEx as a delivery system. The U.S. military, things like prescription drugs, auto parts, all going through that area. We also have one bridge, the DeSoto Bridge, that goes through Memphis. We have something like 35% of all of our trucking commerce on any given day crossing that one bridge and trying to get through that area. So, you know, were a catastrophic earthquake to occur there, the ripple effect for the country would be myriad and years in the making. And obviously that's true for places like Washington, D.C., New York City as well.
What about earthquakes at areas of nuclear power plants like Fukushima? We've got many in the United States.
Yeah, you know, I wrote an article about this for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine and then again for the New York Post. And, you know, unfortunately, the construction of nuclear power plants is how we often find
them. Not very good.
No, you know, and one of the more chilling facts that the scientists at the U.S. Geological Survey shared with me is, look, you know, we have 2,100 known faults in this country. We have exponentially more unknown faults that we just haven't discovered yet. We tend to find them when we build nuclear power plants. That was true with Diablo in California. That was true with some power plants near Washington, D.C. As it turns out, Indian Point Power Plant, which is located about 20 miles north of New York City, is built pretty much directly on a previously unknown fault called the Ramapo Fault. Some scientists say that it's capable of a quite large earthquake, say a 7.0 quake, which they think would do enough damage to affect the reactors there. Even more chilling is the fact that Indian Point, its sister power plant Pilgrim, which is located in Plymouth, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston, these are plants set to close in about, say, 7-8 years. And so they were actually given a pass by the NRC for some post-Fukushima retrofits that would have sort of brought them up to snuff. You know, after we looked at Fukushima, the tsunami, the earthquake, we said, whoa, you know, we better get our nuclear power plants under control here as well, too. They got a pass for some of those retrofits, and that has folks like the Union for Concerned Scientists really concerned and saying, listen, you know, if those plants are going to get a pass, they need to close right now. They don't get to operate for another 7 or 8 years.
We saw when Hurricane Katrina hit, Catherine, how FEMA just wasn't ready. Is it ready now?
It's doing better. You know, I think Katrina was really telling for a lot of people, and it really showed some weaknesses that we have in terms of our first response. I think we get better and better and better with every disaster. But I think if you look at, for instance, Puerto Rico right now, you know, part of the United States, you know, and just
it's a territory
right now.
Catherine, stay with us. We're going to come back and talk more about your work, Quakeland, and also we'll take phone calls. And if you've been in an earthquake, tell us what it was like.